We're back with The Takeaway. I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. Quick, when you hear the name Rosa Parks, what comes to mind? For most of us, it's the moment in 1955 when she refused to give up a seat on a Montgomery bus. Here, she's talking about it with ABC News in 1995.
I didn't feel that it was helping me as an individual, like us as a people, to for me to stand up just because he said, get up off the seat.
That moment has come to define the legacy of Mrs. Parks. It sparked the Montgomery bus boycott and galvanized the civil rights movement. But that one moment doesn't even begin to tell the story of the work she did in her lifetime.
If they could see her out there with the Panthers in Oakland, if they could see her in all of these fragrant varieties of her personality, then they would understand the real Rosa Parks, but they might have been just a little bit frightened.
That sound is from the new documentary, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And Melissa recently sat down with two people behind the film.
My name is Yoruba Richin, and I am the executive producer and co-director of the new documentary, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks.
I'm Jean Theo Harris. I'm a distinguished professor at Brooklyn College and the author of The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, which has been made into this new documentary, which I am a consulting producer on.
This story, the way you tell it, starts off in a maybe somewhat surprising place. The old TV show, To Tell the Truth. Why did you start there?
Well, one of our producers found that clip. And when we found that clip, we thought it was so really crystallized the how Miss Parks was not, everyone knew her name, but no one knew what she looked like. And no one knew who they could identify her. And this was in the 70s. It wasn't that many years later after the boycott. And except Nipsey Russell, who says, you know, I was with her. And she is, you know, not only a great Black hero, but an American hero. And that just crystallized to us, you know, what we were going to say in this film.
Jean, of course, you've long known the ways that Mrs. Rosa Parks has been erased from our collective memories, or at least distorted in them. Talk a bit about the nature of those distortions, to the extent that many people now can call her name, but often don't know the story behind who she really was.
I assume everyone listening to us today knows who Rosa Parks is, has heard her name. I bet most people listening would have trouble calling up her voice. And one of the things that I think the film is going to do is not just give us Rosa Parks' story in her own voice, but Rosa Parks' politics in her own voice. The title of my book in the film is actually taken from a quote from Rosa Parks herself, where she talks about a life history of being rebellious. This is how she describes her own life. And in very much, it's true. She has a feisty side even as a young person. Her activism begins in 1931 with the Scottsboro case when she meets and falls in love with who she calls the first real activist I ever met. That's Raymond Parks. So her activism begins more than two decades before her historic bus stand. She's doing work around what we would call criminal justice issues, voting issues, segregation. So she is a longtime activist before she makes her bus stand. And part of what is incredibly courageous about her bus stand is she's made stands before. Other people have made stands before. There's nothing to suggest on this day that taking a stand will do anything but bring further trouble on her, which it does. And yet she still does it. And then, and we're going to see this in the film, she has another 40 years of activism in the North, in Detroit, in what she calls the Northern Promised Land that wasn't, in and alongside a growing Black power movement in the city and across the country. And again, we don't tend to associate Rosa Parks with Black power, with issues like reparations, with issues like the need for school desegregation, not just in Montgomery, but in Detroit, the need for Black history in every part of the curriculum. So many issues that she's pressing till the end of her life in 2005.
you brought us all the way to the end of her life in 2005, but I want to go back to her childhood just a bit, Jean. This rebelliousness that she self-describes began in part with her grandfather. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So one of her first, what we might say, political memories takes place in 1919. She's six. Again, where we are in history, World War I is over, and Black soldiers who have fought valiantly in the war are coming home. And many people will know this as Red Summer because there is a huge uptake of white violence against Black people across the country. And what that means in Alabama, where the McCauley family is there's an uptake of Klan violence. And so her grandfather will take to sitting out at night with his shotgun, ready to protect the family home. The McCauleys will sleep in their clothes at points because there's so much violence. And at times, a six-year-old, Rosa, will sit with him, as she puts it, because she wants to see him shoot a Ku Kluxer. So that commitment to self-defense, to respect, and respect in the McCauleys doesn't mean the way you act towards others, but the respect you demand of your person begins at that very, very young age, as a six-year-old, as a five-year-old. And we will just see that again and again and again.
Yoruba, many may also not know about the work that she did around sexual assault. You chose to include the case of Recy Taylor. Can you start there?
Recy Taylor was a young woman walking home. She was raped by a group of white boys, white men, and they said they would kill her if she said anything. And she did. She reported it. The folks who are working on the Scottsboro case, folks in the Communist Party, white and Black people, and Rosa, they decided Rosa should go down and investigate and take testimony from Recy. And of course, this is, you know, in the 1940s, terrorism is all around. And for her to do this and to risk this is very, very dangerous work. And Recy's case, justice was never, unfortunately, no one ever got justice, was held accountable for Recy's rape. But she did this kind of investigative work of sexual violence against Black women, which wasn't something that was really talked about even in our own community.
Jean, you also write about the ways that patriarchy operates even within the movement. Talk a bit about, for example, the March on Washington and what role Rosa Parks did or did not in this case play.
So if we get to the March on Washington, there's a couple of people we might want to lift up. One is one of the lead organizers around the March on Washington is a woman by the name of Anna Arnold Hedgeman. And she's a Black woman. She's working for the National Council of Churches at this point. She is responsible for the large percentage of white people at the march, but she's also raising questions about how there are no women scheduled to speak at the March on Washington. She's protesting, Pauli Murray is protesting, Dorothy Height is protesting. And the compromise that A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin come up with is that it's too hard to pick one woman to speak. And so what they're going to do instead is they're going to call the names of a number of women freedom fighters, and they will get to stand up and be recognized. And so one of the women whose names are called is Rosa Parks. And Gloria Richardson tells the story about how Lena Horne and her, in the early morning of the march, start to take Mrs. Parks around to international journalists, international broadcasts that are there to say, she's the real story, you should interview her. And Lena Horne and Gloria Richardson get sent home early from the March on Washington. And Gloria Richardson believes it's because they were doing this work. They miss Dr. King's speech. Gloria Richardson said she's in a cab when Dr. King speaks. So the March on Washington, many women helped to organize it. And yet, no women get to speak. No women get to go to the White House to meet with Kennedy afterwards. And so women are doing the work. Women are doing the organizing. Women are doing the vision, right? And yet this is one of the moments where we see most clearly that vision, that leadership, that organizing, that work not being recognized.
Her experience with Malcolm X was different?
Yes. So they meet For the first time in November of 1963, Malcolm has come to Detroit and he puts out the word among kind of mutual friends that he wants to meet Rosa Parks. And when I was doing research for the book, I learned a couple of things. One was from Peter Bailey, who many people may know was one of Malcolm's lieutenants, particularly in when he forms the OAAU. And Mr. Bailey told me that there were two women in the civil rights movement that Malcolm would speak about in awe, and that's Fannie Lou Hamer and Rosa Parks. And so I think thinking about Malcolm X wanting to meet Rosa Parks, right, that courage needs courage, that activists need other activists, right? That we often think about Malcolm as being some kind of lone ranger when in fact he is also drawing courage and inspiration from other people. And then in other interviews I did, I learned that Rosa Parks would later call Malcolm X her personal hero. They meet for the last time about a week before he's assassinated. She's getting an award that night. He's giving the address and she gets him to sign her program. So sort of a fan moment too. And they have their longest conversation. And so I think seeing, in my mind, seeing kind of Malcolm X and Rosa Parks together changes a number of things that we think about the Black freedom struggle, right? Mrs. Parks had a both-and philosophy. It wasn't King or Malcolm, Ella Baker or Queen Mother Moore. It was King and Malcolm and Ella Baker and Queen Mother Moore. I think the second thing is, again, this that activists need each other, right, for inspiration, for courage, for kind of vision to keep going. And one of the people that Malcolm looked to was Rosa Parks, and one of the people that Rosa Parks looked to was Malcolm X.
I want to talk about some of the filmmaking decisions, Yoruba. Talk to me about the intention to create a non-linear narrative here.
Our task as filmmakers is not only to tell the story accurately, but also how do we make it alive? How do we make it, and especially, you know, with historical films, because it's basically archival footage and sit down interviews. So what can we do? What can we do to bring the story, the heartbeat, to bring vision? And we use all different kinds of tricks. You know, music is a big part of it. You know, obviously how we cut it and how we structure the film. And we felt that, you know, if we could look at these moments in her life and see the long haul of what she was working on, like self-defense and that concept that she always, you know, embraced, and if we could see these moments in her life where they, you know, where we're seeing that, we're seeing scenes that show that, we thought that was, you know, the way to go.
In what ways do you hope the documentary works to preserve the legacy? And what legacy is it that you hope to preserve? And I'll start with you, maybe, Jean.
One of the things that I have been particularly sad about over the years is the ways that Rosa Parks gets trapped on the bus in the past, right? It's that black and white picture of her looking out the bus window when she has so much to give us for today in terms of what it means to be discouraged and yet to still keep going. And so I think the biggest thing I hope for is the ways that the film shows kind of her lifelong commitment to criminal justice, right? Her lifelong commitment to sort of Black history and the need to preserve and teach Black history, her lifelong commitment to kind of anti-poverty work, to global human rights, to reparations, right? All things we need to be working on today and are working on today, and that she kind of shows us how we do so and how we continue to do so amidst years and decades.
I think Mrs. Park's story shows us about the long haul, the long freedom struggle, and how, you know, even in the midst of, you know, she says, you know, people didn't think segregation was ever going to end. They didn't think it was going to end. And the hopelessness and the violence that was going on that she talks about, that people never talked about, that you never saw in the newspapers. But through all of that, you keep going and you keep fighting and you keep demanding and standing up for justice. And I think that's where, you know, if we can take from the film, and if younger people younger than me and can take that from the film, then maybe we do have some hope about changing the dire situation that we are in this country.
Yoruba Richin and Jean Theo Harris, thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.